I'm Dr. Taywise Whitehead. Folks, we have been engaged in this ongoing conversation about the squeegee workers in Baltimore City. It started on Tuesday, it went into Wednesday, and we felt the need to go back around to the discussion for today. But I want to push it in a slightly different direction now. Now that we've talked about some solutions in the first hour, I want to talk about what is the impact of historical trauma on the health of African Americans in Baltimore City. Look at this. We live in a city where our lifespan is connected to our zip code. That if you are born in Sandtown, Winchester, if you're born over in East Baltimore, if you're born in Druid Hills, your life expectancy is about 63. You go 5 miles over, you go over to Roland Park, you go over to Mount Washington, you go over to Hamden, you go to Hamilton, your life expectancy increases by 20 years. If you go into the most economically challenged, predominantly black communities in Baltimore City, you're talking about people where a bulk majority of them live below the poverty level. The poverty level is set at about $26,000 here in America. In Baltimore City, people are living at $24,000 and below. So now, your life expectancy is lower. You have a higher rate of dying from diabetes, a heart disease, of getting cancer, of getting HIV, of dying through traumatic violence. You have 300-plus homicides happening in and around your city and in your community. You're dealing with what I call continual traumatic stress disorder. All of this while trying to either go to school, or do squeegee work, or take care of your family, or figure out a way forward. Research has shown that African-American boys who are born in poverty in Baltimore City have a 0% chance of making it out. Now, if you're like me, that's overwhelming to think about, because 0% means that any African-American male born in poverty who makes it out of Baltimore City, it is the exception and not the rule. And success for our young men should not be the exception. We live in a state where, if you look, African-Americans are in the minority in the state of Maryland. We're one of the richest states in this country. But we are in the minority in terms of our numbers. I get that. I understand that. But if you look in the prison systems, African Americans are in the majority. 70% of all folks in prison in Maryland are black folks. Out of that number, a bulk of them come from Baltimore City. And that age group is between 18 and 34. Look at this, folks. 300-plus homicides, 2019. The biggest age group that died is between 18 and 34, which means in Baltimore City, if you're an African-American male, you have just as much chance of going to the grave or going to the jail. That is trauma on our psyche, on our psychological health. It's trauma that happens to us physically. It says here that racism actually is killing us in this city. Poverty is killing us, whether or not you black and you live in Hamilton or you black and you live in Druid Hills, because when a black person dies, it impacts all of us. So I thought the best person to get was Dr. Corey Henderson. He got his doctorate right here from Morgan State University, but he worked under the direction of Dr. Lawrence Brown. And Lawrence Brown recently left Morgan State, much to our dismay. He moved out of Baltimore City. But you remember Lawrence Brown and his groundbreaking work dealing with the black butterfly and the white L, talking about the fact that the white, you know, economically advantaged communities in Baltimore City cut an L through the middle of the city, and the black neighborhoods make a butterfly pattern around those. And the farther away you are from the L, the more economically challenged you are. Dr. Corey Henderson was also recommended to me by Reverend Heber Brown. Reverend Heber Brown, of course, has what we call what is the Black Church Food Challenge, where he's actually challenging black churches to take all that land y'all got and work with farmers so we can grow our own food and we don't have to worry about living in food deserts. You don't have to worry about that when you connect with black farmers who are bringing in foods, fresh fruits and vegetables for our children into our communities. His dissertation is called The Reverberating Influence of Historical Trauma on the Health of African Americans in Baltimore City. I want to talk about trauma and I want to hear from you. Dr. Henderson, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thank you.
I'm just excited to have you on the show. I received your dissertation. You sent it to me, and I was just blown away with the ways in which you talk about historical traumas over multiple generations. Let me set this up, and then I want you to kind of help us make sense of this. But in your background, your introduction, chapter one, and yes, folks, I'm a nerdy person who reads dissertations because I find them really fascinating, but you talk about the multiple generations of segregation, forced displacement, physical and psychological violence, economic deprivation, and cultural dispossessions. All of these things are impacting Black folks in Baltimore City. So let's take them one by one. Can you talk about the multiple generations of segregation that we have been dealing with?
So before I begin, let me just start by saying that if we're going to talk about historical trauma, we have to talk first about a mass trauma experience. And just by breaking that down, a mass trauma experience, it's not an experience that you have individually. It's an experience that we have collectively. In addition to that, that dominant group that is inflicting that mass trauma on the subjugated population, subjugated meaning those under the power or hand of those who have the power, are then inflicting segregation, serial forced displacement. And we say serial forced displacement because you're not just being picked up and moved, but you're being forced to move. And it's not just one time, but we often talk about in public health the hard-to-reach population. The reason why they're hard-to-reach is because they're constantly on the move. So you can't give someone a resource and then say, we're going to help you, and I can't find you next week. The second part and the third part of that is the physical and psychological abuse. As you mentioned, the physical and psychological abuse is bigger than you putting your hands on me, because those scars will go away. But it's the psychological abuse. One of the things I learned in my research was that Blacks learn to make do. I actually interviewed individuals, and one of the things we came away with was, one, that Blacks learn to make do. But in addition to learning to make do, there was also an emphasis on the lost connections that Blacks had. When you were trying to run and survive, you moved about. And in moving about, you found yourself connecting with people that you didn't even know were relatives. You have found yourself trying to survive and hurting others that you loved, and later finding out the pain or the psychological abuse of hurting someone that really was a distant cousin or someone that your grandmother wanted you to connect with. Men leaving and trying to find jobs and not telling their wives that they moved and found a new job, and leaving their families and meeting someone else in a new state. The disconnect of not having social media, which we use powerfully today. And then the last two, economic deprivation. In Baltimore City, we actually had one of the first African-American CPAs. You could not have a surviving business that was able to build what we would call either in the NASDAQ or a trading company, a large corporation, without having a certified public accountant sign off on your dollars and account for what you did. So since we didn't have Black CPAs and we didn't have a CPA that was eligible to either take a test or to be certified because of the number of hours, then our community lost the infrastructure to build healthy, wealthy community businesses that would survive and build wealth over a period of time. So then the deprivation led to also cultural dispossession. In the 1700s, there's a law in which in the late 1600s, early 1700s, where if a Black child was beat or killed by the slave master, usually it was the woman beating them, then that act was then passed off as not having been a crime. That in itself stripped the ability of a family to punish and to inflict the discipline on their children. So we used all of that to then try to divide ourselves into these sections of, I made it and you didn't. And that's where the historical trauma comes. Because we separate ourselves and we don't come together under the mass experience that we're feeling the trauma. We then separate ourselves and no longer feel it in a mass way. I feel it, and then I separate and I accuse you of how you've caused the trauma, not looking at the population that actually caused the pain.
Okay, so there was a lot there, and I want to try to break it down. So we want everyone to follow along here. So Let me go back to something you said, a couple of pieces that struck me. One is this notion that Black folks learn how to make do. Now, I've often heard that old saying that we don't have to take every crumb they give us just because we're hungry, except that we're in such a constant state of being hungry, and we don't know how to figure out what we can do to not be hungry, that we do reach and grab for the crumbs out of the fear that they're not going to keep coming. How do we get black folks to stop making do? Like, what does that even look like?
So how I define making do, I wrote a blog once that talked about what does it mean to make do? Making do is you calling your cousin and saying you're doing the most. Well, the issue becomes that I'm not doing the most, you're just not doing enough.
Mm.
The fact that we separate ourselves, again, going back to this separation, we create within our own skin color, in our own community, we create these dividing lines of I have and you don't. It was the lack of opportunity that forced the quasi-integration. When blacks ran at the first opportunity to integrate after 1968, the false lie of the Fair Housing Act, that the federal government did admit that they actually were trying to keep blacks out of white communities.
Right.
But when we go back to the question of making do, it really says, am I setting a standard that is so subpar that I forgot, and I talk about this in Chapter 5 of my dissertation, I forgot what it meant for us to work together, what it meant for us to share food, what it meant for us to live in a house together. First generations come into the country and they live under four or five families in one house. They build wealth together. They share wealth. And then they move and each of them buys a house or buys property. What we've gotten away from is the opportunity for us to handle the pain of seeing each other grow.
Mm.
We want to see the growth immediately.
Okay.
We don't want to water it. We just want the seed to just grow on its own. But a seed requires water, it requires sunlight, and it requires attention and nurturing. But we expect, because we have made it out in our own way, to see others then make it out. But we forgot that we were watered, we were nurtured, someone had patience with us.
Mm.
So to make do means that I sit back and I expect for you to come down to my level and say that what you're doing is too much. And what I'm doing is enough. So we then get upset with each other for demanding excellence. I heard someone earlier say on your show talked about biblical references. When you go back to 1 Samuel chapters 16, 17, and 18, you meet David.
Yes.
Saul actually promoted David mm-hmm. because everything he asked David to do, he did excellent.
Mm-hmm.
God was with David. And we forgot what excellence means. And when you do excellent, you are promoted automatically. Whether you get that promotion tomorrow, today, or you get that promotion 3 years from now, your excellence and your standard will be noticed. Just playing the liar.
Now, let me ask you this, and it's funny that you just mentioned 1 Samuel. We've talked about some of the things around David on the show, just some of the lessons around what does it mean to live a life of excellence. You said that we have an issue where we have to handle the pain of seeing each other grow. Do you think that there's a direct connection between that kind of pain that we're dealing with and the ways in which our people are able to commit violent acts toward one another?
Definitely. So let me just take you back to, I'm a reader too. I'm a nerd. I took the SAT in sixth grade. I'm proud of that. My dad worked hard to put me in and made me stay up late, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning studying in elementary school. That's the opposite of making do. Mm-hmm. There was no option.
Right.
We had to be excellent. So the thing that you just described, if we go back to being sick from freedom, great book by Jim Downs talks about being sick from freedom. People think that emancipation meant we just walked out and we walked into Baltimore, we just set up shop. There was a process. So freedom comes with a process. To be emancipated is process-oriented by nature. To emancipate oneself means that, as Bob Marley says, you have to free your mind first. But what happens is we succumb to the pain and pressure of trying to fit in. And it's the idea of the other day, the $470 million of fake Jordans and Louis Vuitton bags that they just found, that they were able to stop coming into the country. Someone said to me, why is that a problem? Because if I'm able to achieve what looks like success before I actually get to
success,
the point of me doing the work necessary to be successful? So when we fake in the funk and when we're making do, getting back to your original question,
that's where we were.
It is where we killing ourselves and killing each other for what we, one, don't own, and two, at the end of the day, we haven't even found a way to co-op with one another to share in resources. So going back to your question, I think that when we left the plantation, some of us left with the idea that we were going to work hard. Others of us felt as though we were entitled to something, that when we left the plantation, someone owed us something. But isn't it a fact, and let's just think theologically and theoretically for a moment, Could it be potentially that God set us up in the most amazing way that we would have never come to this country to be a foundational, structural way to build up this community and this country and this city? Because had we not been enslaved, we would have never been in a position to be here. So if you want to go biblical, you want to go to the Quran, you want to talk some Hebrew or Arabic, hey, we could nerd out. What I'm saying right now is let's take the opportunity for where we are, not making do for what could have been, but let's take where we are and find a way to co-op, work together, and then push out resources so we can get back to tearing down the walls of segregation. If we were a community, there would be no segregation.
Right.
If we then tore down the walls of abuse and love one another, I've been taught through lesson after lesson what patience looks like. That is a hard lesson. I love that the gospel song says, someone was patient with me. I believe it's Anthony Brown.
Yes.
Like somebody had to be patient with us. Economic deprivation. When I have, you eat.
Right. Which is not one of the standards that tend to run in our community. I mean, it's people often talk, and some of it's anecdotal, about this notion of crabs in the barrel, that whenever someone starts to make it from within our community, there is a conscious effort to pull this person down, which I think connects to us not being able to, and I love this statement, handle the pain of seeing each other grow. I want to talk to you about continual traumatic stress disorder, CTSD, because we were talking on this show, and I made the mistake of saying, okay, Baltimore's dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. And my callers flooded the lines to say, it can't be post because it's still going on. We're still in a place where we're dealing with stress and trauma almost every day. So I know that you were looking at Sotero's method of the conceptual model of historical trauma. Can you talk about Sotero's method and then talk about how that directly connects to Baltimore City.
So Michelle Sotero comes out of Las Vegas. She actually did work in the Lakota tribe. Her model specifically looked at the Native Americans. And what happens is when I begin my dissertation, everyone told me I should do something just to get out of school. Mm-hmm. Do something quick, get some secondary data. I took an extra year and a half to read more books and to find people to interview, because what I found was what she discovered was that the source of the information, if you go look at what knowledge truly is, knowledge by definition has nothing to do with what you learn outside of books.
Yeah.
It has more to do with the source of what you learn. If you keep seeing the same thing over and over and over again, keep trying to, as I say, solve the same problem with the same mind that you created it with, that's not knowledge.
Right.
You're just running in a circle. So the source of what you're describing is, she began to realize that the over drinking, the alcoholism, the drug abuse, all of that went back to trauma. And what Michelle Sotero did was, she then put it into buckets. If you go to my website, CJHDRPH, you can just find me online under that tag, you'll see the model that allows for us to then bucket the areas in which we've been traumatized.
Hold on one second. Mm-hmm. Folks, if you're just joining us, this is Today with Dr. K. I'm here talking to Dr. Corey Henderson, whose work on historical trauma looks at the health of African Americans in Baltimore City. And he's taking us through now Sotero's method, the conceptual model of historical trauma, and then trying to help us to connect that to Baltimore City.
So just speaking more about Michelle Sotero, if I can go a little deeper, if you allow me for one moment. So outside of Michelle Sotero's work, one of the things that I did was I said, it's not enough to look at PTSD, as your caller said. It's not enough to look at CTSD. It's not enough to look at Michelle Sotero's work. I looked at post-traumatic slave syndrome, PTSS. I looked at the epigenetic nature of our slavery and how it's in our genetic code of what we pass down, the pain that we've experienced when someone's born. They don't even know what they've been through, but they know that to cry. Mm-hmm. I looked at one family and intergenerational trauma because blacks weren't studied before.
Right.
We've never even looked at how historical trauma. How is it that we're the first in the country to experience historical trauma and no one even talked to us or asked us the question? So in this research, I began to realize they did a quick study on a husband and wife who were arguing all the time because she would cry at the drop of a dime. Mm. And he could not figure out why she cried all the time. They went back and talked to the mother. The mother lost her whole family through the Holocaust. But she never told her children why she would cry over everything. They saw her open the bill, she would cry.
And
they saw her pay the rent, she would cry. They thought that crying was a solution. How many solutions are we giving to people that they are solutions for that time? but we're not giving them the source of how and why that solution helped us at that moment. And then we repeat it. That's historical trauma. And that's where PTSS, PTSD, all of those are layered. Mm-hmm. And then we go to Carter's work. Carter actually tells us in the race-based traumatic stress injury model, what he says is three key things have to happen when we unpack racism. One, it has to be individual, cultural, and institutional. But then the three things that happen to us are racial discrimination. That is the avoidant behavior, barring access and exclusion. We all have had access barred from us, withholding information or use of deception. The second is racial harassment. Have you ever felt harassed physically, interpersonally, abuse, assault, thinking that you're told to be normal because, right. Hey, it's not a big deal. Oh, your dad he went to Vietnam. No big deal. He's just a little out of his mind. Yeah, because they gave him drugs here, gave him drugs there. Right. I'm not going to go there. Discriminatory harassment, aversive hostility. This is where white flight, isolation at work. You sit in a job. I'm in a job where it's not many of us that look like us. I do communications. And what I found is if I don't integrate myself, I will quickly be isolated.
Right.
So you have to learn how to code switch. We got to learn how to talk in a barbershop and talk in a community. We have to be able to talk in the barbershop and not talk in the barbershop all the time, everywhere we go.
Right.
Not barbershop talk everywhere you go, because if you do that, you can't get a corporate job.
No. Nope.
And if you do the I can only talk at work talk at home, then you lose your family.
Right.
And you
right.
wind up marrying outside your race, or you wind up losing your friends.
Right.
So we have to find the combination. So going back to your question, what Michelle Sotero did was she linked the work back to the people. And that's the problem in academia today. Everyone is coming up with solutions that are not about the people. They're just about the solution without actually talking to the people. And that's not a solution at all.
Folks, this is Today with Dr. Kim. Dr. K. Watts-Wahe. We're going to hold it here for a moment. Dr. Henderson, can you stay around a little while?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so we're going to come back and we're going to open up the phone lines. Let's talk about what this trauma looks like in Baltimore City. And then we want to talk about solutions. Keep it here. Dr. K, I'm Dr. K. Watts-Wahe. Folks, we're talking about historical trauma. And what does that look like? How does it show up in our body? How does it show up in our actions? How is it buried so deeply in us? Sometimes the ways in which we're acting, we don't even know it's coming out of a place of trauma and pain. What does it mean to not be able to deal with the pain of seeing other Black folks grow? What does it mean to deal with a community of people who are willing to commit horrific acts of violence against each other? What does it mean to have to walk through this country knowing that as a Black person, you always feel that you are being targeted because in so many ways, you are. So I have Dr. Corey Henderson with me. He has his doctorate in public health from Morgan State University, and we're kind of walking through this. I want to open up the lines, 410-319-8888. Let's talk about historical trauma on the health of African Americans in Baltimore City. Before I get to the calls, and I'm going to start with Lucille in just a second, let me just ask you, Dr. Henderson, for people who are just joining us, can you give us just kind of a truncated version of your research so people can jump into the conversation?
Yeah, so quickly what I did was I actually went and interviewed nine individuals of different age strata from 1925, born in 1925, all the way through those born in the 70s, and talked to them about what does it mean to live in Baltimore. And then from that, I was able to figure out the different areas of where the lack in our community existed in their lives and how the lost connections and also the missed opportunities existed. The first chapter starts out with about a 32 to 35 page history of Baltimore, things that you would never know or learn. I was able to sneak into the archives at Baltimore City Health Department and found records where the Blacks were being called consumptious rats by one of the paint companies. Little things like that you'll be able to discover in my research. But again, it's really just a wrap up of not only do we need to know our history, but we've been indoctrinated to know the history of our country, but we don't know the history of our own people. And it's such a hard conversation because people seem to not want to know. So I'm glad and I'm happy I have the opportunity to share this today because I'm opening up the conversation to start the discourse that we need to have about who are we And why are we being repetitious in the pain that Dr. K just described?
All right, folks, let's go to these phone calls here. 410-319-8888. We have Lucille on the phone from Mount Washington. Lucille, how are you?
Fine, Dr. K. How are you?
I'm doing well. We're on with Dr. Henderson as well.
Yes. I think that our whole educational curriculum in Baltimore City needs to be revamped. If we can spend, I think, about $30,000 per inmate, and only spend, I think in Baltimore City, it's like $13,000 per student. A larger amount of money should be taken to spend on the students. And that might also mean that we might need to go to school year-round. And maybe the curriculum that they have in the summertime would be different than the one they would have in the normal school time. And that we need to find more incentives, maybe even stipends for children once they get to high school, that once they go to school, they reach at least a C grade average, they'll get rewarded some type of way to give them some type of incentive, because what we're doing now just is not working. But we need some type of help for our children because of the traumas that they are experiencing at young age.
All right. Thank you so much, Lucille. So let me ask you, Dr. Henderson, with some of pulling a little bit of what Lucille said, teaching trauma in the K-12 environment, what would that actually entail if we start being intentional and deliberate in helping our children learn how to recognize and name and process and work through this historical trauma?
I think that's the key. I think that Lucille made a very valid point. However, what I would suggest is that the problem has to go back to, if I'm a mass trauma, if I'm in the middle of a mass trauma experience and I am the dominant group inflicting subjugation or pain on someone, why would I want to do anything to make things better for you? If I'm winning, if I'm getting all the money, if I'm getting all the opportunity, the true lie of America is that if you have a fairer skin and you don't make it, and you were promised that you should, that's the true falsity of being in America. So we have to consider that that's not us. We have to go back to that co-op idea. So I think that if we're going to do a co-op of any sort, it means that we all have to take ownership that first, education is not in the school system. It starts at home.
Right.
If my father had not come home and said enough and made me study and said, you know what, forget about you being tired. You ate dinner. You got to do what you got to do. Now I can stay up till 2-3 o'clock in the morning if I need to do an all-nighter because it was taught early.
Right.
He didn't take it easy on us. And I think that if we're going to start with the generation coming behind us, we have to grab them and teach those things of this is what it looks like, this is what you're experiencing, and let it out. This type of discourse, we're taught to not talk. I have my sons and my daughter, and we're all sitting together, and they're texting each other. We're not talking. Mm-hmm. Cut the radio off. Talk to your kids.
But I want to say, in cutting the radio off, you cut it off after 5
after,
p.m.
Yes,
after,
yes.
Today with Dr. K.
I was talking about music.
We have Donna on the phone from Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Donna, how are you?
You're doing, Dr. K, and your guest, Dr. Henderson.
Yes.
Henderson. Yes, hi. I'm a student of behavior health. And Dr. K can know when I call, I always talk about trauma and poverty and whatever. Have you heard of multiple partner fertility?
No.
Okay. Now, when I kept trying to figure out what was causing a lot of the issues of depression and other social economic issues among our women, African-American women, and what popped up in my behavior health literature was multiple partner fertility. And I'm like, what in the world is that? So I went deeper into it and found out it's when, whether it's by divorce, because of, whether women or men decide to have children without marriage, or it could be for whatever reason. Now the U.S. Department of Census now recognizes this new category. Instead of you being divorced, separated, never married, they have this new charity put everybody in called multiple partner fertility. I think something that's an interesting topic to look up.
Okay.
When I went in more in depth in it, I found out that the children of in this multiple family partner fertility, among men and women, the children suffered the most. And it was astonishing to see the history and the why. And so that's something to tap on. But for Dr. K on her show, on you, or what you're talking about, another thing is I find that young girls, we have a lot of young girls who are trying to get answers to why in their community it is, what's going on. Why is my mom cussing at me? Why won't they ask my questions? You hear a lot among the females as well, the young females. That's why when I called Dr. K's show a week ago, we talked about having a sister circle, because these young girls need some dialogue about what's going on around them, because no one else is answering that question. My question to you is, what's the best way to reach you? Because I am in study in mental health behavior.
Well, I'm going to have you hold on one second, Donna. Don't hang up, because we can give you his contact information. What was your second point? Donna, are you with us? I'm saying, if you hold on, we'll definitely give you his contact information, but you had a second question as well.
Right, my second question is, you did home in on why, you know, this intergenerational, why they're killing each other, why young people, because everybody keeps asking, I said it's called trauma, and a different form of trauma, and it's poverty. And until we now start from the beginning, now we can't go, like you said, we can learn from the past, but what do we do with the young people today? I mean, we have to, and for the mental health experts, they're saying we have to get to the time when they're born.
Okay, now I got to stop you there. I'm so sorry, Donna. I got to stop you there so I can get to all the calls. Donna, you hold on so you can get the information. Multiple partner fertility. I just want to break that down. And really, we deal with it in the Black community all the time. And it's just when you have multiple parents, fathers of the same children in a household. So everybody got a different daddy, or everybody's a different mommy. And so the meaning of this multiple partner fertility is this whole kind of, you know, sociological and psychological way of saying it. In our community, we talk about the fact that there are people in the household and everybody's got a different daddy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is my baby mama. I got all these children here and everybody has a different mother. But they're saying that part of that gets into trauma. Mm-hmm. And so I know you may not deal with it under multiple partner fertility, but you do talk about the impact of the family structure.
Yes.
On the ways in which we are relating to and dealing with each other, not knowing who our cousins are, not knowing the different relationships around the different fathers. One father's invited to the home, one father's not because it's too contentious. What's the impact of that?
There's a brokenness. If you were to take a necklace, for instance, and you break one of the links, can't wear it. It's useless. So what happens is when we have a broken link in anything, we find ourselves in this place where we're trying to connect something. And it's a brokenness that forces us to look for partners that we try to heal that area of our life, heal that area of our relationship, not really understanding how to heal it, because we won't go back and ask the questions. A lot of the questions we fail to ask is we've been taught. Part of going back to your question earlier, you said that Blacks learn to make do.
Right.
The learning to make do also comes from this idea of family. That's all we got. It's literally that you can't question what was told to you before you.
Right.
Because questioning the idea seems like you're questioning the person. And that is a level of disrespect that we were taught. We don't disrespect our elders. So it's the idea that when we have that brokenness in our family, we lack the opportunity to feel a connectedness that oftentimes the distractions of social media and all the other things that have us distracted, we never go back to ask the question or to look it up. And then you go up and you grow up. And where you don't go through it, but you grow through it, and then you never really address the pain. So now you're arguing with someone who you really love, but you don't even know how to address and describe love.
Right.
It's infatuation initially, but love says we've been through something together and we've survived it. And until we define that, how do we...
Out of six adults have biological children with more than one partner. It's actually very common when you talk to people who are widows or who have gotten divorced. And additionally, multiple partner fertility actually happens more in the white community than in the Black community. Just want to put that out there. Mm-hmm. We have Michael on the phone. Michael's a new caller from Florida. Michael, how are you? Welcome to the family. Michael, are you with us? All right. I think we've lost Michael. Let's go to Carter, a new caller from Liberty Heights. Carter, how are you? So I don't know what's happening with the calls. I'm going to ask Dre if he can help us out here. So while we're trying to work out what's happening with the callers, let me come back to you, Dr.
I'm on here.
Hey, Carter, how are you?
How you doing?
I'm doing well. I was a little bit concerned. Things were happening. Thank you. You're on with myself and Dr. Henderson.
Dr. Henderson?
Yes.
How you doing, Dr. Henderson?
I'm doing well. How are you, Carter?
So what was the topic, Dr. K?
I
came in late.
Okay, no problem. We're talking about historical trauma and the impact of historical trauma in Baltimore City and the health of black folks in the city. So because of our historical trauma and because of the ways in which we've had the impact of slavery, lynching, Jim Crow on us, segregation, redlining, the Baltimore City is in a continued state of trauma and pain. And we're talking about how to get out of that.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So thank you, Carter, for calling and checking in. We're going to go to Michael. Michael's a new caller from Florida. He left Baltimore in 1969. How are you, Michael?
I'm fine. And yourself?
I'm doing well. Thank you for calling back.
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can. Do you know if you can turn your radio down and listen to me on the phone? Good.
Okay. No. Oh, no. Okay. I got to turn the radio down?
Turn your radio down. You can just listen to me on the phone.
Okay. Let me turn it down.
All right. All right, tell me once you get
okay,
that done.
Okay, I turned it down.
You got it down, so now just listen to us on the phone. You can talk to us here. How are you, Michael?
I'm fine. Can you hear me fine now?
I can hear you fine. Thank you, sir.
All righty. My name is Michael Gwynn, and I wasn't born in Baltimore, but I was raised there.
Okay.
I have a long history. My family has a long history of the city of Baltimore and the state of Maryland. My name is spelled G-W-Y-N-N. Historically, it's rooted in the Baltimore geographical history. Nevertheless, we're not talking about me. We're talking about my folks, my people. And I am the byproduct of a person who migrated away from Baltimore in 1979. I left there based on my experiences as a young man. I'm 60 years old today. But then in 79, I think I was about in my early 20s. In poverty and the reciprocal door of the Great Castle, Baltimore CDC system, the Department of Corrections, the police system, and also the opportunity. Now, mind you, you know, it's been several decades since the 70s, but the same conditions existed today, existed then. It was an assault on black people, assault on the people of color, and specifically their male children. There wasn't no jobs, opportunity. It was a lot going on in Baltimore at that time where you could see that, I don't know, the powers that be was like choking Baltimore out. And its youth, its economy, its real estate was really beautiful then, but it was, how do you say, it was desolate. I used to live in those old desolate buildings.
Mm-hmm.
I know. And now it's devastating when I look at a show like The Wire or I look at different videos on YouTube about Baltimore, and I see they leveled it to the ground. I'm like, man, what happened to the solution? What happened to the politicians? What happened to the church and its powerful money? And it's, you know, them reaching the people, but I guess the problem was overwhelming because it was intentionally created to gentrify the city of Baltimore and push our people out and take back that real estate.
All right. Thank you so much, Michael. I'm going to stop you there. So Dr. Henderson, just to kind of look at how Michael is kind of giving us a little bit of the history, to just pull three simple situations that have happened, and I know they're complex and complicated, but just kind of pulling them in, and I'll truncate them. One was Destiny Harrison, a black woman who, 21 years old, shot in her own business. Shooters came in. The shop was full. Sprayed the place, people ran, they left her one-year-old daughter by herself. She was shot in the head and killed because she had given the names of the people that had robbed her. Two, a 73-year-old woman was recently killed. She was going to the hospital, shot in broad daylight in the stomach with bullets meant for someone else. But bullets, of course, have no name. And then three, with the killing of the community activist Sam Davis, that the person jumped out of the car in traffic, running down the street, shooting a gun, and then jumps back in the car, and their cars are all around. And in all these instances, no one saw anything. Now, we know people did, but people don't want to come forward. Can you talk a little bit about just the experience of dealing with ongoing trauma that you can't share? You can't name the killers. You can't do anything but just hold on to it.
The pain of carrying around things that you want to sit down, that baggage will erode you. And I think that what Michael described is a problem where we can't trust the police. We can't trust who we call. We can't trust our neighbor. We have to get back, and that's why this conversation is so important, that we have to get back to a place where our conversations are no longer a conversation we do in the dark. We do them openly, and we talk amongst ourselves. In the early 1900s, after the Great Fire of 1904, they moved all the blacks from downtown, which was once the harbor, but it's the harbor now, from living downtown and dropped them off in Druid Hill. And they forced them to move there because they burned everything and flattened it. The point of that is, over time, after the tuberculosis and the lung block, all of the things that happened led us to not trust the police, not trust our leaders. If we are going to be in a position where we go back to solving these murders, fixing these problems, and getting people to be able to trust one another, we have to have a central way of communicating. Right now, if I fear my life, I'm not going to say anything. But if I could trust that you know me and you know my pain and you know my community, and I know as a police officer you just want to go home because you're afraid, just like I'm afraid, then we are now talking the same language. But the problem is we're speaking past one another. So we have to get to a place where, as a community, we continue to have these conversations. I am actually now going around talking around the country and speaking to our churches and community organizations just to start the conversation about what is the trauma that we're carrying and how are we going to heal from it? Because we got to drop it off somewhere. You can't carry these bags because everything that you put in your trunk that you avoid to deal with, it will eventually load your trunk up, and now your bags are on the outside of your vehicle. And when you start driving down the road, all your business is in the street because those bags were not tucked away properly and they came open. I'm writing a book right now, so
we've got to lay it out here. Folks, I want to make a note that I incorrectly stated Sean Davis's name, community activist Sean Davis. I said Sam Davis. It's Sean Davis. We have Kofi on from Columbia, Maryland. Kofi, how are you?
I'm doing excellent, Dr. K. Thanks for asking here. And thank you and Dr. Henderson for being on the show today here. I just want to kind of camel back on what Dr. Henderson said, something about knowing our history or knowing ourselves here. And the reason I brought that up is I'm doing some research myself here on us from, I guess, the beginning of time. So if you can kind of touch base on what he meant by that.
Okay, and no problem. And what we'll do is we'll take that offline, Kofi. I want to give you his contact information. You said, because I know that in the first chapter, you actually go back, you know, and lay out the whole historical continuum of how we as black people, like, how did we get here? Mm-hmm. Not just here in America, right, but in Baltimore at this moment, why does this city look the way that it does? And you talk a little bit about this in your dissertation. Can you just kind of give us a kind of a short overview to go back in that information of how did we get here? Like, why do we look the way we do? And why are we feeling the kind of pain we are in the city?
So just very quickly, and I'll do this in a minute. If you go back, and we're talking millennia, millions of years ago, we actually had more than six different types of Homo sapien, Neanderthal. Homo sapiens actually come out of Africa. They are the most social group. The reason why we are the ones surviving is because the Africans knew how to communicate and how to share with one another. So when I walked into your community, I had my homeboys with me, my homegirls with me, and when we shared resources, we knew who to trust and who not to trust. Fast forward thousands of years, millions of years, we then get to a place where they find that we have resources in Africa. They pull up on the backside of Congo and the Mani-Congo, who has an expansive territory across all of Africa. His territory is so big, he doesn't even realize that they're snatching people out. So by the time we're not communicating with one another, it's too late. They even snatched his nephew and put his nephew into slavery. We then get to 1619. They land on the shores of America. America is too far away from Africa. They say, look, we can't kill them. We need to find a way to mess with their minds, because it's too far of a trip to go back versus those in South America and those in Brazil and other places. We can just get more. So here they then begin to beat our children and play mind games, bring us from different cultures and different languages, breaking down communication. How we got here from 1619 to 1864, 1863, we then on watch night waited for slavery to end. They then came up on in Galveston, Texas and said, y'all free? We like, oh, we free? Okay. Well, freedom didn't mean freedom. It meant emancipation with the process, and there was no proclamation because we really couldn't vote still. We then went to this time period where we had to go in the 1800s and fight. That's what we call Reconstruction. Black codes. Oh, blacks can't own guns. We don't want y'all to have weapons. Florida passed laws. Everybody did everything they could to keep us away. Whites in the North, they didn't want us to have opportunity. They just didn't want us in our neighborhood. They didn't want the Southerners to have too much wealth. Fast forward to the 1900s, we come to Baltimore with all of our trauma on our back, over 4,000 lynchings from 1877 to 1950. You carry that pain with you anywhere, you're going to carry that pain with you everywhere. We then taught our children how to survive by making do. We then found ways to just make do and how to survive without the opportunity that was afforded. Black doctors came here in the 1900s, said, hey, can we go to Hopkins and get a degree? No, there are no black doctors. The AMA said, no, there's no such thing as a black doctor. They even put us in their manual and said colored beside their name. How do we get here? It was through a lot of pain, but it was through love. Mm. How we got here? Through grandmothers praying for us, somebody feeding us, somebody loving us. Every time you go to your grandmother's or an elder's house, they say, baby, did you eat? That's how we got
taking
here.
Care of it. That's how we got here, folks. This is why the city looks the way that it does. And we know that you got to take a look at Dr. Corey Henderson's research to delve deep in it. You got to go get that copy of 1619 that Nicole Hannah-Jones put together that we give out on the show all the time to understand how we got here. You got to take a very long and hard look, a loving look, really, in the mirror at yourself and say, what am I doing that either keeps us in the situation or helps us move out of it? It's one or the other, folks. 410-319-8888. Brother O's on the phone. Brother O, how are you?
I'm fine, Doctor. And Dr. Henderson, how y'all folks doing today?
Doing well, thank you.
I am loving this, loving this, loving this. You know, one question I wanted to ask the doctor. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please, go ahead.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Some of that research that in your dissertation, it reminded me of what I ran across back in the 60s while the projects was designed.
Mm.
And they said the projects was designed on the mice in a maze, rats in a maze. That's how the projects was designed over certain parts of the country and why they had to separate the blacks from the whites. And then when you see when all this is torn down, it's got the city in a big scramble. Hmm. But I like to research myself, and maybe some kind of way I can get some of that dissertation.
Yes, can you hold on 1 second? We'll take your contact information.
Doctor, real quick.
Go ahead, brother.
Do you see the information on the depopulation and how you can probably relate some of that to some of your information.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Brother O. Hold on 1 second. Let's get your information. So I want to kind of take both of Brother O's comments here. So first, when he was talking about the projects, this idea of the rats in a maze or mice in a maze, which I think is interesting. Now, my dad in D.C. worked for the housing department, worked for HUD for many years in terms of understanding the concept of the projects. We call them the projects, but they used to be called the projects. It's supposed to project you out into the community. It's supposed to be a place you go and kind of get financially situated and then project you into a different community, except that black folks and economically challenged white folks moved in and weren't able to save up enough, move up an income level, and so it became a permanent situation with this, what he said, the one way in, one way out concept. But that is also a way that keeps us economically tied to these economically disadvantaged communities because we can't work ourselves out of them. So what do you do?
It goes back to the idea of a co-op. We have to find a way as a community to bank out resources, to really get to a place where we actually work together collectively to come up with solutions. We can't do this on our own. We weren't put here on our own. It's mass trauma for a reason. I will quickly say that what Brother O mentioned was so impactful to the research because when you go look at, in my dissertation, Chapter 1, I talk about how the projects were first established. And in the establishment of the projects, Hopkins actually did a study where they took people randomly and they moved them and dropped them into these projects like they're like a project and then took elders and they worked with the city. and didn't tell people that they were doing this. So you would randomly get a letter saying, that, oh, we found new housing for you. And the grandmothers and mothers later found that their children could not connect back to their old community. So we got to get back to a place where we work together collectively. I'm happy to come out and do talks and start the conversation.
Thank you. Folks, this has been Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead with Dr. Corey Henderson. If you want his contact information, be sure to call. We can get that to you. Make an appointment. Meet me back here tomorrow at 3 p.m. Let's plan to have another conversation that matters, one that gives us healing, gives solutions, gives us options, and help us work ourselves out of this situation. It's been an honor and a privilege to serve you in this way.